This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. Mark is also co-founder of the Solutions Project, a group that combines science, business, and culture to develop and implement science-based clean energy plans for states and countries. Mark Jacobson is here today to tell us about a 100% wind, water, sunlight, all-sector energy plan for Washington State. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Diane. I'm glad to be on the show.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about the Solutions Project?
Sure. Well, this started a couple of years ago, about almost 3 years ago, really to first develop state-by-state plans to change the energy infrastructure of each of the United States to totally clean and renewable energy. So all-purpose energy really is electricity, transportation, heating and cooling, and industry. And so the idea would be to switch all these sectors to clean energy. And so for electric power, we'd be going to like wind power, solar power in different forms, water power in different forms, including hydroelectric, although that won't change very much, some geothermal, some tidal and wave power. And then for transportation, we'd be switching to electric vehicles, primarily with some hydrogen fuel cell vehicles where the hydrogen is produced from electricity. And so we'd basically electrify the transportation sector. Heating and cooling would also be electrified with heat pumps, such as air source and ground source heat pumps, a little bit of electric resistance heating, and also heat pump air conditioners, which is just running the heat pumps in reverse. And then industry, all the high temperature processes would also be a drive from electricity and some hydrogen. And so this would essentially allow not only stable energy supplies, because all the raw source of energy would be natural wind, water, and solar power, but also clean energy, since there'd be virtually no pollution associated with any of these energy technologies. And since the fuel is all free, there's zero fuel cost, so we wouldn't have rising prices of energy over time. And since the infrastructure requires development, it would actually create jobs over the next 40 years and really grow the economy. But the Solutions Project, the goal was to take these plans, which are science-based plans, and we've ultimately now developed plans for each state individually of the United States, and then try to actually educate the public about them and educate policymakers about them, and then ultimately get them implemented by getting people to understand what type of energy they can have, and then hopefully the people will then affect policymakers, and policymakers hopefully will see that this is something that's better for not only the economy, but for the health of people in each state.
Why focus on energy plans at the state level?
Well, we actually first developed completely renewable energy plan for the entire world, and then we went to the United States, but we realized that at those scales, it's just impossible to get agreement to make such changes. And so we really needed to start at a smaller scale, and some states are very active at trying to make changes, and others are more slow, but if we actually get some examples where we actually do have success in some states, even one state, where we can go to 100% renewable energy, then others should follow. Whereas it's really difficult to make rapid changes at the federal or international levels right now.
Would you say more about your overall approach to developing energy plans at the state level? How did you gather the data for your plans?
Well, we start with raw data for the current energy use for each sector of the economy. And then we extrapolate that forward to 2030 and 2050 based on projections by U.S. energy agencies, and also looking at population growth, changes in energy demand. And then we do a conversion where we go sector by sector and technology by technology, saying, okay, if we converted, let's say, this coal plant to, you know, wind turbines, how does the energy demand change? Or if we convert from gasoline vehicles to electric vehicles, how does the energy demand change? And one of the interesting findings, actually a very significant finding of all these studies, is that just by electrifying everything, changing from combustion to electricity, you really reduce power demand significantly without actually changing any habits before even end-use energy efficiency improvements are put into play. Because electricity is just so much more efficient than burning things. For example, an electric car, the plug-to-wheel efficiency is 80 to 86%. In other words, 80 to 86% of the electricity going into the car goes to move the car, and the rest is waste heat. Whereas a typical gasoline or diesel car, only 17% of the energy embodied in gasoline goes to move the car, and the rest is waste heat. So by going to electricity, you actually reduce power demand in vehicles by a factor of 4 to 5. And this is why the cost of a gasoline car is on the order of $4 a gallon or more, whereas the cost of an electric car driving it is about 80 cents a gallon equivalent. So a person who buys an electric car and drives it for 15 years, 15,000 miles per year, will save on average about $20,000 in fuel costs because of the efficiency of electricity over combustion. And we found that if you look across the entire energy economy and do these transformations, that you would actually reduce power demand by about 35 to 40% just by changing to electricity. And then we assumed another 5% or so additional reductions due to end-use energy efficiency improvements, such as people using more efficient light bulbs or weatherizing their homes or using more energy-efficient appliances, walking more instead of driving. But some studies have indicated that you can get end-use energy efficiency improvements of up to like 25% reduction of power demand, but we are very conservative in assuming only a 5% or so reduction, so that our plans are actually easier to implement if people actually conserve more. So in the bottom line of all this, there's a significant energy demand reduction by going to electricity. There's additional end-use energy efficiency improvements that can be made. And then once we determine the new demand in 2050 based on projected growth of demand over time, we look at the energy resources available, the clean energy resources like wind, water, and solar, and say, well, are there enough resources in each state to actually power that demand in the state? So for Washington State, we did such an analysis, and we said, yes, there's plenty. We actually mapped the winds and mapped the solar resources available. We know the hydroelectric, there's already significant hydro in the state. And we then do, you know, one scenario to say, well, what's one way we can actually power Washington State for all purposes in 2050, assuming a conversion to electrification of everything? And so, for example, in the Washington State plan, we propose about 35% of the 2050 power demand would be met by onshore wind, about 13% by offshore wind, about 26% by hydroelectric, 100% of which is already in place, so there would be no growth of the hydro, it's just using existing hydro. About 18% would be solar PV or photovoltaic power plants. About 4% would be residential rooftop solar. About 2% would be commercial government rooftop solar. And less than 1% would be geothermal, and a tiny amount would be wave and tidal power. So this would power the entire state of Washington for all purposes in 2050. And of that total proposed power, about 17%, mostly hydroelectric, is already in place. In fact, 6% of the onshore wind is also in place as well. And then we looked at the land areas required to do such a conversion and found that the land required is only about 0.3% of the state's land. So 0.3% of 1%, so less than 1% of the state's land, much less, for what we call footprint, which is really mostly solar PV power plants, because rooftop solar would just go on existing roofs for the most part, or parking structures, and so that's not new land. For the onshore wind, we'd also need about 2% of the state for spacing between wind turbines, but that land can be used and is used for multiple purposes, such as rangeland, farmland, pasture land, open space. And so it's actually not land you're putting concrete on, except for the turbine tower bases, which are really tiny areas. So we looked at the areas, we looked at the resources available, and then we did calculations. Well, okay, so to produce all these structures, we then calculated how many wind turbines we need, et cetera. Each of these wind turbines and solar panels, et cetera, requires jobs to create and install and run and operate. And we calculated the number of jobs that would be required over 40 years. And then we looked at, well, how many jobs would be lost in the existing fossil fuel energy infrastructure and nuclear infrastructure, and found that in the Washington State case, we'd create about 42,000 more jobs than we would destroy, and these are 40-year jobs. Then we looked at, well, what are the other benefits, including reductions of air pollution, health, and climate costs, and found that in Washington State right now, there are on the order of about 1,000 premature deaths per year from air pollution, and tens of thousands more illnesses and injuries. And this costs the state about $7 billion per year, or 2% of its GDP. And so eliminating the air pollution by eliminating fossil fuels in the state would reduce these costs, or eliminate these costs, in fact. And then the state actually contributes to about $10 billion per year, or will in 2050, about $10 billion per year in global climate costs from the state's own greenhouse gas emissions. And so these costs would be eliminated. So that's a total of about $17 billion per year in health and climate costs that would be eliminated by these plans. We translated that into actually cost per person and found that there's a benefit for each person for the conversion.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University and co-founder of the Solutions Project. Our topic is a 100% wind, water, sunlight, all-sector energy plan for Washington State. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you underscore the specific goals you have set for energy in Washington State in your plan?
Yeah, so the specific goals would be we want to convert the energy infrastructure of the state 100% by 2050. However, we'd really like about 80 to 85% of this conversion to occur by 2030, which really means that by 2020, we would need all new sources of electric power to be clean, or what we call wind, water, solar, WWS. And whenever there's a retirement of an existing power plant or vehicle or even heating and cooling device, that would be replaced by a cleaner device running on electricity. And so natural transition would eventually allow everything to be converted because, you know, power plants typically have a lifetime of 30 to 40 years and vehicles on the order of 15 years. So there could be a natural transition if you just, every time you had to replace something, you make it clean. However, that's not fast enough if you just do it naturally. And so we do need policies put in place to speed up the conversion. So this is really where communities and individuals and policymakers can come into play to effect a transition to really speed up this thing, which there's really no loss by going towards 100% clean renewable energy. I mean, it creates jobs, it eliminates air pollution and climate costs and health problems associated with the pollution, and it stabilizes the energy prices. I would really like to emphasize and illustrate how you stabilize energy prices by going to clean energy. For example, in the United States, the 10 states with the highest fraction of their electricity from wind, which start with Iowa and South Dakota, which are on the order of 27-28% last year, those states, the cost of electricity during the last 5 years actually decreased by about 0.4%. So although those 10 states significantly increased the amount of wind in their portfolios, and people say, oh, you know, well, that should drive prices up. But in fact, the cost of energy during the last 5 years in those states went down, whereas all the other states that did not invest so much in wind, that actually invested more in fossil fuels, their cost of electricity went up about 7-8%. And the reason is because fossil fuels have finite and growing fuel costs. You have to keep mining for oil, coal, and natural gas, and you have to transport it, and you have to refine it. And in fact, Hawaii, the cost of energy doubled from about 17 cents a kilowatt hour to around 34 cents a kilowatt hour during the last 10 years. And that compares to about 13 cents per kilowatt hour for the U.S. average. And this is solely because of the high cost of mining and transporting and refining fuels. So there are all these benefits to going to clean energy. There are very few downsides.
So if the goals of the Washington State Plan are met, how much reduction in emissions will take place compared to business as usual?
Well, if the goals of this Washington State Plan are met, we would eliminate 100% of all emissions of both greenhouse gases and air pollutants in the state of Washington. Well, virtually 100%. I mean, there's still some natural, for example, natural fires and some pollution associated with, for example, cooking. But it's virtually 100%, at least, and it will be 100% from the energy sector. So business as usual, on the other hand, we're going to grow the emissions, not decrease them. So we have a choice of going down to zero emissions from the energy sectors or growing them compared to today by 2050, somewhat proportionally to population.
And what will be the significance worldwide if the goals of the Washington State Plan are met?
Well, the significance would be there's the actual direct impact on, like, for example, global emissions. We had estimated about $10 billion per year in global climate costs reduced due to Washington state emissions alone. But really, more important, you would be setting an example for other states, especially Washington state. It has such an advantage right now because it has so much hydroelectric already in place, and hydroelectric is a great form of storage, so that it makes it much easier to match power demand, you know, minute by minute, hour by hour in Washington state than other states. So there's a great opportunity in this state to be the first to go to 100% renewable energy. And doing so, this would affect other states and other countries by saying, oh yeah, if a state as big as Washington state can make such a change, then so can other states and countries. And I think that would really help to spur changes worldwide. So this is one of the reasons we'd really love Washington state to be the first, or one of the first, if not the first, state to commit to 100% renewable energy.
Looking at the plan for Washington state that you've put forward, how does this compare to other existing Washington state energy plans?
The existing state plans are all forward-thinking, and so they all have goals of, most states, in fact, have what are called renewable portfolio standards, which really focus on the electricity sector to convert the electricity to wind, water, and solar, for the most part. But usually these are very modest plans, like either 20, 30% changes. And even though, you know, most states by 2050 will want even greater changes, but our plan is really to change all sectors to 100% renewable energy and really change each sector. And so it would maximize the benefit in a shorter period of time. So Washington state is really on the right track and is going forward, but at the current pace that things are going, we wouldn't get to 100% change to wind, water, and solar by 2050. And I can't say exactly what the current plans in Washington state would lead to by 2050, but I would guess that unless more aggressive measures were put in place, we wouldn't be more than a fifth of the way there by then. You know, maybe by 2100, you might get to 100%, but certainly not by 2050.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University and co-founder of the Solutions Project. Our topic is a 100% wind, water, sunlight, all-sector energy plan for Washington state. Would you again tell us what the energy mix will look like in 2050 if your plan for Washington state is implemented?
Yeah, for Washington state, we'd be about 35% of the energy mix would be onshore wind, 13% offshore wind, about 26% hydroelectric power, all of which is already in place, about 18% solar photovoltaic power plants at the utility scale, so more in the desert areas, and then about 4% residential rooftop photovoltaics, about 2% commercial government rooftop photovoltaics, about 0.7% geothermal, and the rest, less than 1% combination of tidal plus wave power. And so this would be 100% of all sectors, electricity, transportation, heating and cooling, and industry in Washington state in 2050.
And could you also mention again the specific energy resources in the different sectors, for example, in transportation?
For transportation, we would use electric vehicles where the electricity is derived from wind, water, and solar technologies. In some hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, maybe for long-distance trucking, some ships, and even aircraft would have to use some hydrogen, maybe cryogenic hydrogen, which is low-temperature hydrogen that was used in the space shuttle, for example. It has also been used in some aircraft. For heating and cooling, we'd use heat pumps, which run in reverse as air conditioners, and they extract heat out of the air or out of the ground, and probably in Washington state, out of the ground, since that would be a more stable source of energy. And for high-temperature industrial processes, we'd either use resistance heating or hydrogen combustion, where the hydrogen is produced from electricity from wind, water, and solar. So everything would be electrified. We'd eliminate carbon and virtually all combustion, except for tiny amounts of hydrogen combustion. But even that would not emit any carbon or carbon dioxide or particulate matter or most other traditional air pollutants. And so this would really transform everything, so people could actually go running along the street and not have to inhale car exhaust or diesel truck exhaust. it's really changing the inner cities. I mean, there would be clean inner cities. I mean, you could be pleasant. You don't get this pollution that usually haunts most inner cities of the United States and around the world. People's health will improve. You reduce cardiovascular disease, reduce respiratory illness, reduce complications from asthma, reduce hospitalizations, emergency room visits. This would all result in reduced taxes, reduced insurance rates, reduced workmen's compensation rates, greater work days, greater school days, because people would be sick less and more productive at their work. So there are all sorts of positive feedbacks that would occur by reducing the air pollution and making people's lives healthier through this energy plan.
Given the mix of energy sources you propose, how effectively can power supply be matched to demand? How reliable will the grid be if your plan is implemented?
It will be reliable, just as reliable as it is today. In Washington State, it's actually easier because about 26% of all the power that will be produced for all purposes will be hydroelectric, which is already basically a big battery. And so, you know, when the wind's not blowing, the sun's not shining, that's when you can turn hydroelectric on, and you can turn it on and off pretty instantaneously. And this is without adding any new dams, just using existing hydroelectric in Washington State. Now, in this new economy, it's totally different from the existing economy because since we'll have electric vehicles and we'll have industry all electrified, these are what are called flexible loads. So in other words, more than half of all the power demand will be very flexible. So let's say there's no wind or solar in a given hour and there's not enough hydro even to fill in demand. There's this thing called demand response management, where you give a favorable rate to consumers or, let's say, industry people or to people who own automobiles and say, well, if you just plug in your car or if you just require power sometime during the day, we'll provide the power sometime during the day, but not necessarily, you know, at this particular hour where there's a huge demand. So you can actually shift the time of peak demand to when the electricity is suddenly more available. So that's called demand response management. And with this new paradigm, where more than half of all the power demand is flexible, that you can actually shift the time that you use it, that actually makes it much easier to match hourly power demand, in addition to the fact that you have this big battery, such as hydroelectric storage, and the fact that there are other storage technologies that can also be used. So in Washington State, we think it's the probably by far easiest place in the entire United States to match power demand reliably. But you can do the same thing in other states as well.
What policy steps are needed to bring the Washington State Energy Plan about? What are the best steps for implementation?
Well, we think that each state has to determine their own policies. I mean, we propose possible policies that could be put in place. And we're really proposing this is the end goal, and the policymakers have to really dig deep and say, well, this is how we're going to achieve that goal. But certainly, in each sector, there can be policies put in place to encourage solar, to encourage wind, to encourage electric vehicles. Offshore wind particularly needs encouragement. Since there is no offshore wind in the United States, there's a lot in Europe, but it just hasn't been put up in the United States yet, although there are a lot of proposed projects that are pretty close. And then, you know, changing the heating and cooling, to electrifying that, electrifying industry. So really, anything that gets towards those goals of 100% renewable energy in each sector, policies can be put in place, but we don't want to specify what exact policies should be put in place.
What do you see as the greatest challenges for Washington State in bringing about this all-sector energy plan that uses only wind, water, and sunlight?
Well, we've always said that the challenges are not so much technological or economic. They're more social and political. It's really educating the public about what's possible and then convincing people that, yeah, change can and should be made and it needs to be made. It's really a social and political issue. I mean, certainly there are practical issues like transmission. That can be something that slows things down because, you know, nobody wants to put new transmission lines, but sometimes you might need them. But on the other hand, we'll be eliminating natural gas pipelines and refineries and nuclear power plants. So you're eliminating some infrastructure and you're replacing it with some other infrastructure. But nobody wants to add anything. There's always this NIMBY or not in my backyard mentality, so that will slow things down. So I think that's certainly an issue. And even though the cost of energy will be lower with wind, water, solar technologies, what's called the amortized cost, or the cents per kilowatt hour of electricity generated, will be lower under this plan. Renewables have higher capital costs, but zero fuel costs. So whereas traditional fuels have lower capital costs, but high and rising fuel costs. So to get the capital investment to actually make the change is also a challenge. But we will have to replace things anyway, so it's really just trading off more upfront capital for lower costs over time. And the total cost over time, when you integrate it over time, will be lower as well. But convincing people to spend money up front is always a challenge. It's not an insurmountable barrier, but it makes it more challenging.
What response have you gotten to the Washington State Energy Plan so far?
Not a lot, because we haven't really publicized it very much. We've done the analysis. We've written a paper. It's being considered for publication. Since it's not published yet, we haven't advertised it a whole lot. We've spoken to a few people about it, and there's a lot of positive thoughts. But there's always the normal concerns about how will this affect policy, how will utilities react, because nobody likes to change things. And so whenever you're proposing, and I wouldn't say it's a radical change, but some people might say it's a radical change, they're going to be resistant. And so there's going to be some resistance, we expect, but we haven't really pushed it. We'd love to be able to speak to more policymakers and Governor Inslee about it, because we think that the governor would be really interested in this and would have a proclivity towards making changes in this direction.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think that changing the energy infrastructure is technically and economically feasible. There are social and political roadblocks that need to be overcome, but this is something that I think people would benefit from in the long run. It will create jobs, it will stabilize energy prices, you'll provide a stable form of energy for centuries to come, and you'd reduce air pollution, reduce climate costs. So I think there's only a benefit and little downside to it. So I hope people will really end up being interested in trying to affect these changes.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Mark.
Thank you, Diane.
You are just listening to Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University and co-founder of the Solutions Project. For more information, check on the web at thesolutionsproject.org. Again, that's thesolutionsproject.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Power 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.